This is On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at what is happening in Western New York with news, features, and special guests. Now, here's your host, Penny Wolfgang.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to On Target with your host, Penny Wolfgang. We're here every week, and we talk about subjects that we think are important and in the public interest to all of us who live here in the Western New York community. And, of course, one of my subjects that I'm obsessed with, as you well know, is law and order, as we call it, anything to do with our safety here in Western New York, with any issues that have to do with, as I just said, law and order. And the buck stops here with my guest when we talk about law and order here in Western New York, because I am fortunate enough, and you, my audience, are fortunate enough on Target to have an opportunity to get some information today from our Western New York U.S. Attorney, James P. Kennedy. And Mr. Kennedy is the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of New York and has been since November of 2017. And I'm sure that you have heard from him before, and he is a familiar name to all of my listeners because he is so involved and has been so influential in so many of, especially, the improvements and the radical, I want to say, changes that have been made in law enforcement in many ways, and the issues that have arisen in the last couple of years since he has been in office. As a matter of fact, I'm lucky he's talking to me. We're lucky he has 5 minutes even to spend time talking to our audience because he is such a busy person. Hi, and thank you, Mr. Kennedy, for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Judge, for having me on.
Well, I like to keep our audience up on all of the issues that we are facing, as I said, to do with law enforcement and to do with law and order here in Western New York. And I think, as I said, the buck stops here because the U.S. attorney has so much to say about and so much has wide jurisdiction. I wanted to, ask you to let our listeners know what the jurisdiction is of the U.S. attorney. And I think one of the questions that people always have is, what's the difference between the U.S. attorney and the district attorney?
Sure. So the Western District of New York is comprised of the 17 westernmost counties of New York State. So there's four federal districts in New York State. We here are in the Western District of New York, and our jurisdiction essentially covers Buffalo and Rochester. There are 93 different federal judicial districts across our country, and we are one of those 93 districts. And I'm very honored to serve as a U.S. attorney. And in that role, our office, as you can imagine, has the obligation to prosecute any federal crime that happened here in the Western District of New York. But we also have a civil division, too, where we defend the United States against civil actions, but also, importantly, have an affirmative civil section where we prosecute cases involving fraud, waste, and abuse against the government. So, Judge, I really enjoyed your introductory comments, and I think, you know, as you said, you're a big law and order person, and I think it's no coincidence that at the Robert F. Kennedy Main Justice Building down in the District of Columbia, where our Department of Justice is headquartered, there's a Latin inscription on the wall which reads, "Everything is created by law and order." And so I share your sentiments and your affinity for law and order, and it's been certainly a challenge over these last few years. We've really had some challenges in that area of law and maintaining order in our community.
Well, maybe we should, you know, talk about that because it is so current, about jurisdiction and what actions the U.S. attorney has to do or is involved with when there is civil unrest.
Right. So, I mean, it's really, as you know, your listeners know, we've dealt with it sort of beginning in May with the civil protest relating to the George Floyd incident and other incidents. And then within our own district, the Daniel Prude incident in Rochester, that also fell within our purview and all of the civil unrest related to that. And then more recently with what happened in January 6th down at the Capitol building and individuals from our community that traveled down there and participated in the insurrection down there. So where we have jurisdiction are cases, you know, in situations in which there's been a violation of federal law. And as I'm sure you know, and your listeners may well know too, Congress decides by enacting their laws what they want to regulate. And one of the things that they, the reasons why things become federal law is because there's a federal interest. And oftentimes that involves the Commerce Clause and interstate sort of activities historically. So in the arena of these civil disorders, there's a statute related specifically to civil disorders and individuals who, during the course of a civil disorder, engage in acts of violence. There's also particular statutes dealing with, for example, use of fire and explosives, burning cars, interstate threats of communications. We obviously, with now the ubiquity of the internet and everything, and telephone calls and text messages and the like, individuals use those outlets as well as social media to threaten one another, and that can give rise to federal jurisdiction as well, along with other sort of activities, lesser use statutes. But those are the primary statutes that we use to prosecute these cases. And, you know, we have a great interest in ensuring individuals' First Amendment rights, and we have to balance that. And this isn't, our efforts in prosecuting these cases aren't done in any way to try and impede that important First Amendment right. Rather, it's directed at conduct, and really that's what we're talking about is conduct here. This isn't an effort to quash any speech or anything like that. It's an effort to quash bad behavior, and that's why we bring these cases, and you know, we'll continue to do so to protect our community because, as you say, that's where everything springs from. I think it's the first duty of the government is to protect its people.
And that reminds me, when you said free speech, it reminds me of a lot of the cases, and one of your probably divisions now, have to do with the internet. People, either pornography on the internet, threats on the internet, I can't think of any other violations, but there are other violations that you have. Computer crime, actually, I guess we're calling it, is a very serious issue that the U.S. attorney deals with as well.
Oh, it is, Your Honor. Definitely. From the threats that you've described and I spoke of earlier, I mean, to cyber-stalking statutes, child exploitation has become just exploded. When I began in this office in the early 1990s, the only child exploitation cases that we prosecuted federally involved individuals coming in from overseas at our international border here at the bridges, bringing in films from Europe or Sweden, you know, elsewhere, which depicted acts of child rape and things like that. But now, you know, it's sort of, the history is actually fairly interesting, because I think back in the mid-90s, there was sort of this push away from viewing adult pornography as sort of a harmless or victimless crime. And although I don't agree with that, because we've seen with human trafficking cases and the like that that's not the case, but just generally within the government, there was sort of, we turned our attention away to other matters, and that turning our attention away coincided with the explosion of the internet. And when we finally looked back some years later and realized, you know, what was out there, it was very disturbing. And so we work closely with our partners in the FBI and Department of Homeland Security to prosecute those child exploitation cases. And then there's other also uses of the internet, whether it's you know, international sort of threats to our economy through fraud, through economic espionage committed by foreign actors. We deal with that here extensively, protecting foreign enemies that may be attempting to infiltrate the computers of our businesses, our military, our educational institutions here to steal proprietary information and secrets. So those are all cases that we work. It's a very broad playbook that we have to work from.
And that is so, so important now to in the whole country. And it's so much on the forefront of law enforcement and of the federal government, as far as, you know, dangerous threats from China and from Russia and from other countries on the internet regarding that. So it's really amazing that we in Western New York are on the forefront of dealing with that, too. And also, speaking of being on the forefront, I know we've had a lot to do with Homeland Security here in Western New York because of Canada, because of our borders, because of our location. And I know you've been involved. Your office has to do with that as well.
Absolutely. So Yeah, the four ports of entry here in our district are the busiest at the northern border. So, I mean, obviously, with the border being closed presently because of the pandemic, that's changed things a little bit. But certainly, because of some of the more lax immigration laws that exist in Canada, I mean, when there is full commerce between the two, the threats here are very real, whether it's drugs going to and from Canada, from the United States, or down from Canada. We see that, and we're seeing that actually increasingly lately. There's been some pretty significant marijuana seizures here at the northern border, which is something that's, you know, been not really the norm in the past. I think it has to do with sort of the cartels getting involved in marijuana production and distribution, and you know, certainly other drugs too. Historically, a lot of the sort of designer drugs, club drugs, if you will, used to come down from Canada into the United States, and you know, we prosecute those cases here. But now we're seeing increasingly a flow of drugs up into Canada. But beyond all that, too, because, as I said, of you know, the easier immigration standards up in Canada, along with the tremendous relations, obviously, that we enjoy with our Canadian neighbors, it's generally perceived that some nefarious individuals will have an easier time getting into the United States rather than trying to sneak through the southwest border, which is, as we know, is somewhat more fortified than generally the open border that we have here at the northern border, that when those individuals try and sneak in here, oftentimes are here to do criminal acts as opposed to perhaps just seeking economic opportunity.
And that is something that we always have to be cautious about. And this is before COVID, going back, you know, to 9/11 almost, because I don't know if this is a true fact, but people believe that the 9/11 terrorists came through Canada. So,
well, certainly some of them did.
Yeah,
I think that is a fact. And yeah. And but yeah, it's so it's we have to remain vigilant there as well.
Just want to interrupt. If you just tuned in today, you are listening to On Target with your host, Penny Wolfgang. And today we have the honor and privilege of talking to our Western New York, the U.S. Attorney for Western New York, or for the Western District, James P. Kennedy. And we are talking about the issues involving law enforcement as well as the jurisdiction of the U.S. Attorney. And very often when I see a conference, a press conference, or something that you're involved with, I notice that you are with the other law enforcement, like with our district attorney, with local police, with people from whatever the Bridgeville Authority. So there must be definitely a cooperation agreement between all of you to deal with these issues together, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that, as you mentioned just a few moments ago, that's one of the lessons learned from September 11th. Mm-hmm. And the non-sharing of information is did so much harm there. And we learned so many lessons from that the need to share and to work cooperatively, federal, state, and local. So, you know, John Flynn here in Erie County, you know, the new district attorney up in Niagara County, as well as all the other district attorneys, we communicate with them regularly. And you know, we've sort of Mr. Flynn and I had an agreement early on, and that we've abided to this day, that you know, we're not going to worry about who's going to get credit for you know, prosecuting these cases. We're going to worry about doing all that we can to ensure the safety of our community. And so we work together. Literally, we communicate, our offices communicate on a daily basis, discussing cases and where they can best be prosecuted. And, you know, I think that, again, goes back to some of the other comments that you made earlier about working together to create law and order in our community. Because, you know, I think without law and order, our communities just cannot survive and much less prosper. And I think, you know, that's one of the concerns that I have. You know, some say, we can't address crime by simply going after the criminals, and instead you have to take, you know, address the root causes of crime. But, you know, if you think about that, there's certainly some truth in that, but better education can certainly be in order. But, The schools can't, you know, redeem our young people if they're overrun by gangs, and businesses can't take root and provide better jobs and more opportunities if our streets are shooting galleries. And I think that, you know, tough law enforcement isn't the only solution for a crime. We certainly recognize that, and we have to address the pathologies that contribute to crime. But, you know, the question that really bothers me these days is, how do we reach the point in this country where our solutions to these difficult problems are either or propositions, you know, where we become so polarized and so one-dimensional in our thinking, you know? And I think really we need to step back and say that strong law enforcement and improvements to our social fabric and economic conditions and opportunities, especially, you know, in minority communities, which are seeing such an adverse impact and increase in violence, those are complementary approaches, not alternative approaches. But we can't do it alone in law enforcement. We really need the help of the community to do this as well.
Let's talk a little bit about gangs. Do we have an issue here in Western New York? And if so, what is, you know, causing it? And also, more importantly, from law enforcement, how are we handling it? How are we trying to target the people who are involved? And how are we trying to curtail the violence?
Well, yes, we do have a problem, and I think that's obvious to anyone that watches the nightly news. Violent crime nationally this past year is up significantly. In Buffalo, it's up 40%, the murder rate, compared 37% nationally, 40% here in Buffalo. Gun assaults are up about 10%, and in Buffalo alone, shootings were up 90% last year. We went from 188 shootings in 2019 to 355 in 2020. And I think that, you know, obviously the pandemic has something to do with this increase in violence. So does the sort of deteriorated, as we spoke about, the civil unrest and this deteriorating relationship between law enforcement and the community. But gangs are certainly an important part of this as well. And, you know, historically, we've been very aggressive in this office in prosecuting gang cases, and we remain that way. We use very, I think, creatively, the RICO statute, which was designed to fight organized crime, sort of traditional organized crime that we might think of with the mafia and things like that. We've sort of pivoted and used that statute to go after our violent street gangs, and we had tremendous success, for example, in the 7th and 10th Street case on the west side of Buffalo, really changed the fabric of the community on the west side, and I think we can see that today. But our work isn't done. We've seen, historically in Buffalo, it's been a lot of neighborhood, sort of loosely knit street gangs. Instead now we're starting to see some of these larger national gangs, the Bloods and things, come in. And, you know, I think one of the things that we've noticed when we talk a lot of these gang members is, you know, a need to belong and a feeling of a need to belong. And that's why this gang life becomes attractive to them. And we've seen, you know, it historically used to be shootings were often tied to sort of drug turf and things like that. But increasingly, it's people are getting shot over posts on social media. You disrespected me. And, you know, to try and address that, Mr. Flynn, the district attorney, myself, Commissioner Lockwood, Deputy Commissioner Grimalia, and Chief of Detectives Dennis Richards last year went to Milwaukee right before the pandemic in March of 2020. And we observed there a unique model known as a shoot review, which we actually brought back here and incorporated in Buffalo. And what the shoot review is designed to do is to increase police accountability for and solvability of non-fatal shootings as well as fatal shootings. So the theory being that if we can drive down the number of non-fatal shootings, we're also going to drive down the homicide rate. So we've been working hard to get that going in some very challenging conditions amidst the pandemic. But, you know, also, too, we've, as the police commissioner is a big advocate of community policing, which I think is very important to this process, too. Again, it's not an either-or proposition. We need to have some of those softer skills, too, to enhance that relationship between the community and law enforcement so that people are willing to come forward if they have information. But there's other impediments, too. Most recently, for example, the New York State's Bail Reform Act has inhibited the ability of prosecutors on the local side to lock people up and keep them incarcerated. And if people you know, get arrested for a crime involving a gun or something like that, the likelihood that we can garner cooperation where the person that we're asking to cooperate knows that that person will be right back out on the street, it becomes very difficult. And so that's, again, sort of where we communicate with our state and local partners, because we have a little better opportunity or chance of having people detained pending the resolution of their criminal cases. So these are all efforts that we've taken to continue to try and drive down the violent crime rate here in Western New York.
Well, when you mentioned the guns or the shooting and cooperative efforts, what the big issue, or one of the big issues, is how are we going to keep the guns off the streets, because they can't shoot people if they don't have a gun, and how are they getting the guns, and where are they getting the guns from?
Right. So, I mean, that is a huge part of our effort, is stemming the flow of firearms to violent criminals. I mean, these guns are sort of the tools of the trade, you know, among drug traffickers, gang members, and other criminals. So, you know, we work closely with the FBI, and that's part of the initiative. We had a recent meeting with some of the ministers here in the city to address this illegal flow of guns into our community. They come from, you know, a number of states that have more lax laws regarding gun control. So we see a lot of guns that are being used in crimes here in our community being sourced from states like Ohio, states like Georgia, and elsewhere. And so we've been able successfully to prosecute some of those cases of these traffickers that are using straw purchasers and the like to bring in these guns to our community and really flood our community with them. But as I also point out, however, you know, while no one's really sure how many guns there are in our country, the best estimates I've read are about 350 million, which is a gun for every man, woman, and child in our country. And so even if we were to stop all flow of guns into our community right now, there'd still be, you know, 10 years from now, about 350 million guns in our community. So while we try and divert, you know, or subvert the flow of these illegal guns in our community, we also try and get rid of those that are willing to use guns and pull the trigger. And so that's really a two-pronged approach. And when I say get rid of them, there's two ways to do that. One is to lock them up, and the other one is to change them and provide these opportunities and some of these other things so that they don't have to turn to gangs and a life of crime. And so it's really a multifaceted approach that we're trying to use here to address this violent crime, very concerning violent crime increase that we've seen.
And what you said is so important. It's not either or. It's not an either or situation. There's no reason why you can't work with the community and also, you know, strictly enforce the laws so that, you know, it's got to be, we've got to get people off the street who are a danger to others. So it's got to be both. What also, this applies a lot of what we're talking about, the guns, to drug trafficking.
Sure, and we've seen, just like the increase in violent crime this past year, we've seen a huge increase in overdose deaths. Just yesterday I saw the numbers for 2021, and I think that we're at about 290 overdose deaths after we had gotten it down to basically under just over 100 in the past 3 years. And that's because of a very aggressive approach that we've taken here that really has three prongs: prevention, treatment, and enforcement. And so obviously prevention and treatment are to deal with those that are addicted. We've tried to take care of them and heal them, but at the same time there's also a very important enforcement component, and we've been very forward-leaning here federally in charging what's known as a death result statute, which is carries with it a 20-year mandatory minimum sentence for the individuals who distribute drugs which result in the death of another. We've charged over 25 individuals here successfully with that crime, and we're one of the top 10 districts in the entire country of those 93 districts I've mentioned for prosecuting deadly fentanyl cases. So we've been very forward-leaning, but at the same time, you know, hats off to state and county officials, to our medical community, providing increased access and to treatment and prevention opportunities, getting some of the drugs, Narcan and other drugs that can be used to counteract the effects of these deadly opioids out into the community. And that's why, you know, I think we've seen a huge increase during the pandemic because some of the usage patterns have changed where people, because of their socially distanced, I mean, obviously everyone's feeling sort of the ill effects of isolation and sort of desperation that comes with this pandemic. But then layer over that the fact that people are using alone, there's no one there to administer Narcan to them to save them. So it's been a real problem and one that we're working close, you know, with, you know, it's a public health problem. So we're working with the public health commissioner as along with all the other things that they have going on with the pandemic, but also with the law enforcement and the treatment community as well.
I'm on the Erie County Opioid Task Force, and they had a meeting this Monday, which is what you're referring to, when they gave the statistics, which were just so disappointing and discouraging that, you know, there had been such a decrease in opioid deaths up until the pandemic, actually. And now this past year, there's been a great spike. And a lot of it, as you pointed out, and as they pointed out at the task force meeting, has to do with COVID, the effects of COVID, the isolation, the inability to get treatment. You know, that ordinarily we had been concentrating on treatment, and now during COVID it's been so difficult to get people into treatment. So there's a lot of issues. And I meant to ask you how you have been able to deal with COVID. Has it affected your office and law enforcement in any way?
Well, it certainly has. I mean, I think probably less than some people might imagine. I'm proud of the fact that within the Second Circuit, which is, as you know, Judge, but your listeners may not, all the 93 districts are divided into 12 different circuits, federal circuits, and we here in New York are in the Second Circuit along with Connecticut and Vermont, and we're the only district in the entire Second Circuit that was able to maintain our grand juries throughout this pandemic, and that's, you know, credit to Chief Judge Geraci, who sort of worked with us along with the other judges in federal court here to allow us to keep our grand jury operating so that we can continue to charge individuals who break the law amidst the pandemic. And I think, you know, I'm very proud of the tremendous prosecutors and support staff that we have here that have allowed us to sort of continue operations as best we can. I'm not going to lie. I mean, it's certainly been, you know,
a challenge.
Right, but it's been a challenge.
Thank you so much. We actually have learned so much talking to U.S. Attorney James P. Kennedy here on Target, and we thank you so much for your time. We hope you've all enjoyed and learned something from our conversation, and will join us again next week on Target with Penny Wolfgang, same time, same place. Have a good week, be safe, and thank you for listening, and goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at Western New York and our community. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to Penny Wolfgang at 500 Corporate Parkway, Suite 200, Amherst, New York, 14226.